There's a legend round here. A killer buried, but not dead. A curse on Crystal Lake. A death curse. Jason Voorhees' curse. They say he died as a boy, but he keeps coming back. Few have seen him and lived. Some have even tried to stop him. No one can. People forget. He's down there, waiting.
Friday, October the 13th, 2006, which is
Friday the 13th.
You are listening to Friday the 13th Special Part 2, the second one.
Jamboree.
Yeah. And it's going to be a hell of a show.
It's jam-packed, all Friday the 13th lore and legend that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, and I am Rita Cosby.
That's right. He's going to report on some abduction stories later.
Just kidding. I am the Creepy Duggan.
And I am Uncle Bill, and right now, we're going to talk to you a little bit about what we've got planned for you on this Friday 13th.
Creamy horror goodness.
First up, we're going to tell you that we've got the first ever Friday the 13th horror roundtable.
That's right. We have Colonel Scott W. Perry, who is an independent filmmaker, along with a huge Friday the 13th fan known as Scab Boy, who also posts on our message board.
And almost every other Friday the 13th message board.
That's right.
But, yeah, we got that coming up. And then a little bit later after that, we're going to get to some fan mail. And then we're going to go to our interview, which I know we haven't, like, told anybody who our interview is going to be with yet. Because, yeah, to be honest, we didn't really know who our interview was going to be with until about a week ago. But we've got the writer of the first Friday the 13th film, Victor Miller.
That's right. Vic himself, creator of Jason Voorhees. So you'll get to hear that. And just wanted to let everyone know that, you know, I'm not really sick. I just had like a case of laryngitis after the last show. I lost my voice entirely until about Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And I thought he was dying. And, you know, I was going to break out the liquor and KFC, but
I need some. I probably do need some liquor.
Yeah,
I really do. Some peach brandy or something.
Lubrication, if you will.
No, I don't need that. Anyway, though, we can get right to the round table if you want to do that.
Yeah, here's the thing. We're going to go ahead and just kick this Friday 13th special off with a bang. This is the Friday 13th whole round table. First ever, right here.
That's right. Only Friday the 13th on Friday the 13th here at DudeBit.com.
So this is the, I guess, the fourth round table that we've done now. First one about Friday the 13th. First we have Colonel Scott W. Perry.
Colonel's original recipe.
Yeah. Who is a writer, director,
producer,
yeah. And also we have, I guess, from the board, Scab Boy,
yep,
from many different Friday 13th boards as well.
Yeah, super fan of Friday 13th.
So, if anybody who doesn't want to start first, we'll go ahead and start, or if you want to, go ahead.
All right, well, I'll just say real quick that, you know, it was actually a Friday the 13th movie that actually got me interested in making films in the first place, so.
Which one in particular?
It was 4, the final chapter. I was 7 years old when it came out, and I couldn't see it in the theater, but when it came out on video, I really wanted to see it. And my parents, they were kind of concerned because of the rating and all the attention it was getting from, you know, all the conservative people of the world. And so what they did was they rented a Tom Savini tape. I think it was Scream Greats at the time.
Yeah.
And they told me, look, we want to let you know that this is fake. This is not real, so don't be scared by it. So watch this first. And I got so into the effects that instead of being scared by it, I was basically looking at the effects and seeing how they did it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but still, you know, I mean, I still love the film. It definitely brought on a lot of effective scares in it as well. But you know, from that standpoint, I just wanted to make films ever since I saw that, just seeing how it was made and everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and open up this question again, I guess. As a series, how do you think that Friday the 13th stacks up against, like, other franchises like A Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, you know, Hellraiser, all those other series?
I personally think that from a horror, or at least a slasher standpoint, that it's at least as good as any of them, probably better than most. I would say maybe the Nightmare on Elm Street, at least I think a lot of those were a little better done, but Friday the 13th was the only series that made me want more, made me want to, you know, eagerly wait for the next one. And Nightmare on Elm Street never really had that impact on me. Matter of fact, none of the other franchises really impacted me as much.
Yeah.
All right, I kind of agree with that. I think the main thing, I think the impact on it, I think mainly has to do with the character of Jason itself.
Mm-hmm.
No. Because out of all the franchises, you know, I mean, the Nightmare on Elm Street, they were better made films, Halloween series, Hellraiser films, but Jason was the only one out of those particular monsters at the time that he was really he had the most sympathetic qualities about him. Yeah, you know, Freddy is pure evil, Michael Myers is pure evil, Pinhead is the fucking king of evil, if you get down to it. But
well, he was technically a victim to start off with.
Yeah, and I think there was that kind of relation, I guess, to it, you know, where you can actually relate to a little bit of it. I mean, you know, there's definitely some alienation as a kid, I think, as I felt it as a kid. So there was definitely that quality about Jason. You can kind of understand his background. He didn't have a good one. Mm-hmm. So,
and you can also even root for him in a way because, you know, you kind of like you said, feel bad for him. At the same time, he's, you know, fucking a lot of people up. But it's just something you can kind of side with. You know, with, like, Freddy Krueger, you really couldn't side with him too much because, you know, he's a little more screwed up. And
the whole child killer thing.
Child killer. And then, you know, even with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is a franchise that, you know, the first couple I really liked, and then it just started getting really bad. So...
Yeah,
you know, Leatherface is kind of like someone you can also sympathize with, but at the same time, he was just really, really, you know, you just didn't know who he was and didn't know why, and I think that's one of the reasons why, just, or at least I couldn't sympathize with that part because I had no idea why he was doing the things he was doing, which made it a lot better.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, I thought the Friday the 13th series as a whole was... You know, I like them a lot better than the Nightmare on Elm Street series, which went significantly downhill after, like, part four. So,
yeah.
And then the character Jason, I think it's one of the first characters of the sort that was actually, you actually rooted for him, you know. Especially after four, I think, when you have a lot of the characters that are meant to be hated, I believe, so.
I agree there. I think also to what Scatboy was saying, I think the difference, there's a lot of similarities between Leatherface and Jason, but remember, Leatherface has his family, Jason's alone. There's nobody really to kind of guide him in a sense.
Yeah. He's a one-man wrecking crew.
Exactly.
I have to think as a whole, at least for me, the first five are just really, really fun movies in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, the characters are at least people that you can at least sort of relate to, or you knew people that you can relate to that were like that. And I guess part three is my favorite, and it was really weird because all the characters in that movie were so different from one another, and it just reminded me of the people that I used to hang out with because I lived on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and the people that lived near me, I mean, they had to be, I mean, you either hated them or you liked them, and I had to like them because then I wouldn't have any friends, and they were just so weird, you know, just a huge mix of people. And just easy to relate with, and they're really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see it in 3D?
No, I have the DVD that's in 3D. It's a pain in the ass to watch it. It gives me headaches. So
I think for me, probably because I was a kid when most of these movies came out, yeah, I think it had a lot to do with the innovation of how they were going to kill the people off. The series itself, as it compares with Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street, I never looked forward to seeing people get killed as much as in Friday 13th movies, because you knew it was going to be something completely unique, and I just always went into it looking forward to seeing how they would come up with ways for Jason to dispatch people.
Yeah, it seemed like in a lot of them they, you know, probably wrote the kills and then wrote the script around it, or at least it seemed that way, which I
guess. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I just realized that when Jason killed it, with all the kills, they were pretty much quick deaths. There was no suffering involved, really. It was just basically, that's it, you're dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, which in all of them, I think that also added to it.
Yeah, I think Jason wasn't really sadistic. I mean, Freddy and Michael Myers were both kind of, especially Michael Myers in Halloween 2, were both kind of sadistic about the killing. Jason just was just a means to an end. He'd just get rid of people.
Yeah.
Kind of move on.
Yeah. Fast and Furious. Let's just fast them as quickly as possible. Yeah. And that was that.
But, yeah, I think as far as a series, that's probably my favorite series as a whole.
So about the third one is your favorite? I liked up until 5. I like 5 a lot. But after 5, it just didn't have the same feel. And although I do like 6 and 7, 7, I like it a lot. But there's just something missing from that movie that... I don't know. It just gives me a really weird feeling when I watch it. It doesn't feel the same. It kind of feels like it was going downhill at that point.
Yeah.
And pretty much the redeeming qualities in that movie was either Giancarlo Bigler or Kane Hodder or both.
Definitely the makeup in that movie.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much in agreement on that one.
Yeah.
I would. I'd actually say though, as far as the series goes, Part 8 was probably like especially the second half of that movie. Just completely was different from anything from previous, like Friday the 13th.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how it. I guess it's really couldn't shoot in New York for that long, and maybe that made it look just look generic. I don't know.
Yeah, it is more budgets, and the budget killed that movie. I personally think it shouldn't have been written, knowing what kind of budget it would have. But I don't know. The first part of that movie, I liked it a lot up until. He got off the boat. I don't know why I liked the part when he was inside the boat. It just felt like, you know, sort of old school. But, I almost cried when I watched that movie for the first time.
I think maybe because it brought back, maybe if you with the boat, maybe it brought back the setting that it was a new setting for Jason to be in, but it also, you know, one of the things I like about the earlier films that I think the later ones kind of missed was that you had that sense that you really didn't know where Jason was going to pop up next.
Yeah.
Where by the time 6 and 7 came along, you pretty much knew where he would be.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the scares are already set up for you.
Yeah.
8 kind of, you know, there were a few things around the boat that, you know, you really didn't know what was going to happen, who was going to be next. And so maybe it did bring that feeling back to it, maybe when you saw it. So.
Yeah, in a way, when he was on the boat, it was shot sort of like the point of views of, like, you know, like 2 and 3 to where you knew Jason was around, but... He was sort of stalking and kind of looking around corners and waiting for the people to come to him, sort of like in Part 3, where he, you know, up until, like, one point, he just let everybody come to him.
Yeah.
Me, personally, I think 8 is the weakest of the series.
Oh, but, yeah. Easily.
I think Jason Goes to Hell is my least favorite.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Maybe I'll have to retract that comment.
I would say, actually, Jason X, but that's just...
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like... When New Line took over, it didn't feel like Friday the 13th to me at all anymore.
No. It was Jason. That's what it was. It was the Jason show all the way.
I guess you can say, I mean, to me, Jason, I don't even really consider Jason X to be part of the franchise.
That's probably a good idea. Good policy
to have. I think it was a start on trying something new without actually going the remake route.
Anytime they put somebody in space, that kills a franchise.
Yeah.
That's just a given, you know. Hellraiser, Leprechaun.
Yeah. That was horrible.
Anytime anybody goes into space, that's it. You need to start over. Or the hood. If you go in the hood. Anywho.
I'll just go on. How do you guys think that the series affected the slasher genre?
I mean, it's kind of interesting because... there are a lot of people who debate that Halloween really started the slasher franchise, and it did. And there are some people who consider Friday the 13th to be pretty much a copy of Halloween, which really isn't the case at all, in my opinion.
Well, actually, we talked to Victor Miller earlier today, and he was told to just basically copy Halloween. That's what he said.
Okay.
So that's pretty much what he did. Yeah.
All right. Well,
I think that Friday the 13th started the actual, you know, the woods camp, you know, that type of slasher. Well, I wouldn't say they started. There was a few before that, but they made it profitable because so many movies after that just completely copied the formula. And some did it well, some fucked up and like, made really bad movies. But I think they sort of started that aspect of it. I mean, I guess you can say the slasher movie, you know, goes back to the 60s, really, with Psycho. But I think it definitely started the backwoods.
Yeah, definitely.
The slasher craze, at least.
I always think, though, back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre as starting a couple of things that had to do with, you know, maybe probably slashers, it's not necessarily what I would call a slasher, but it started a couple of things, like, for instance, the lone girl that survives at the end and, you know, stuff like that. But as far as Friday the 13th goes, I think that the big thing that did for slasher movies was actually the randomness of the people that got killed.
Yeah.
It just introduced, like, anybody can get killed at any time.
Any character for them.
Yeah. And they were just kind of disposable teens.
Yeah, and the ones you like most, you could never count on them surviving because a lot of times they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that if it wasn't for Friday the 13th, all the movies like The Forest and Don't Go in the Woods and even Sleepaway Camp probably would never have been made, actually.
I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, agreed there.
Yeah, it definitely started this. I guess that would be what the survival trend of
slashers.
Okay. Might as well talk about it. You know, you guys, I guess we all know that New Line's trying to do a remake or a reimagining of it. And anybody see the new Chainsaw that came out last week?
Yeah, I saw it twice.
You saw it twice?
We haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Is that an indication that you liked it?
No. I didn't know if I liked it or not the first time.
Okay.
It got me really dizzy because the camera work is sort of trying to be documentary, but really bad Blair Witch Project style, you know, which I like Blair Witch Project a lot. The camera is just, it just made me dizzy in a lot of parts. But it seemed like they tried to pack an entire history in a 12 to 24 hour timeline, and it just was just way too much going on. And I thought it was at best like a C-.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I kind of think for a film, for me, it was a film that was supposed to take place in 1969. It felt to me that it was a film that took place today.
Yeah,
and I just couldn't buy into that. But
yeah,
you know, it's just that director is supposedly on tap to do this supposed reimagination of
Friday
the 13th. Yeah,
and
I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm not too sure about it. I'm kind of hoping because I mean, the one thing about it is that it won't have Michael Bay's name attached to it.
Yeah,
so I'm hoping maybe that'll be some kind of saving grace to it, but. Do you think that maybe it is time to redo the series, so to speak? But no, they're doing it with Halloween with Rob Zombie.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a really, really hard question to answer because, I mean, some people are going to hate you for every answer you give, but I think, yeah, it is because, you know, if they make a sequel, I mean, you can always, like, kind of just start off from nowhere like Jason Goes to Hell did. It's going to leave a lot of continuity errors, but... I think a remake would definitely work because it at least start it back off to where it'll get back to where it was, you know, in part 2, 3, 4, 5. But at the same time, you give it to the wrong person, it's just going to be crap, and it's going to be really hard to watch, and it's going to start off a whole new franchise that's going to be worse and worse and worse. So
I just remember going on... When the news broke about it the first time, going on Friday13films.com, and when you first logged into the site, the webmaster had posted like an open letter to Platinum Dunes, I think, that basically said something like, why are you doing this? You know, what need is there for this, and why would you even want to do it? And that just kind of struck me as, I mean, because that's pretty much, I think, how most of the fans feel about these remakes, is why are you doing it?
The sad thing, too, is if they get started doing the remakes, will they ever go back to the original series?
I say no.
I don't know. And
I mean, I agree that it probably does need to change somehow because after I said, like, you send somebody into space, that pretty much is it for the fans.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're definitely going to have to start, you know, basically start from a new area.
But if you, I hate the way they do the slick style remakes they do nowadays, especially the Texas Chainsaw.
Look up music videos.
And you know, a lot of people I know probably like to see anything that has to do with Friday the 13th now, because Freddy vs. Jason, but I can't get behind that concept.
I just don't understand, like, with the concept of Chainsaw. I mean, if you want to take Friday the 13th back as a remake, maybe you should film it in a way that it was filmed back then. I mean, I just saw the previews for the upcoming Grindhouse film.
Yeah.
And that looks like it was made in the 70s.
Yeah, you can do it.
Looks really good. I don't understand why they don't do that. It just looks too polished to me. Even when they try to make it look like, even with Chainsaw, they make it look all, you know,
That's just that. Yeah, that's that Lionsgate style where they try to. It all looks.
Everything looks like Hostel and Saw.
Yeah, it's all green and looks like That's not really, but.
Well, I think that's what they're using. Maybe Scott would know more about. Like, they use just digital cameras now, or.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, in the area I'm in right now, I mean, pretty much digital, the way the technology has gone the last 10 years, you know, it's pretty much, for a lot of us, you know, our primary source of filming. In one case, it could be a very good thing if you use it right. And, you know, part of the thing, one of my biggest concerns about the remake is that they're already planning a release date before the script's even written.
Yeah.
You know, that shows, you know, it's just like, hey, getting out of date. It has to be on a Friday the 13th, of course. And, you know, what care are you going to put in the product for the fans?
Yeah, well, I don't think the fans are any concern anymore.
No.
So it doesn't matter. But if you could tap somebody to direct that film, and I'm sure most people wouldn't tap Jonathan Liebesman, but who would it be?
I think I'd get Rob Zombie. I don't know why, but I guess after I see the Halloween that he's doing. I just like the Devil's Rejects, the way it was shot. He was really convincing to make it look vintage.
I think if the Texas Chainsaw movie was shot like the Devil's Rejects one was, I probably would have liked it a little bit better.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think it's just because I like the way that he did the films. Or maybe it's just because I like the films. He didn't have that much to do with it. But Steve Miner comes to mind for me.
Yeah. Most of the Friday the 13th films, though, I mean, it's just. Most of the directors, you really don't know who they are.
He's got some experience doing the films, and they turned out well, at least the ones he did back
then. I'm actually surprised that, because he did 2 and 3, and they look completely different from each other. And I guess maybe that's because they had to use the 3D technology for 3.
Yeah. From what I read, a lot of the directing in Part 3, I mean, he directed it, but there was also the 3D director, which he had to... pretty much change a lot of his directing style to adhere to that, and then some of the shots he wanted to get he couldn't because, of course, they had to shoot it to be with a 3D. So
there was a director of photography that had to like change the lighting all the time. Come in and rearrange all the stuff he was trying to do.
Because if you look at that film, everything, every single element in every scene is just evenly lit. Because for that, I mean, where it's like in Part 2 or even in, you know, in every other film, there's a lot of shadows and a lot of darkness. So I, you know, maybe that's. Why, for you guys, I know you said you liked 3 a lot. Maybe that's why it's a favorite amongst many, because of that feeling, because it does give it a little bit more of a scarier setting when you don't know where Jason is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the overall feel of 3 was very different.
Oh, it definitely was.
I'd like to know exactly why the DVD wasn't released in 3D. I mean, you know, that seemed to be a gimmick that would sell.
I don't know. I've heard a lot of things from that it just be too costly to... you know, to release it in 3D just because of the way it was shot.
It was a clear kind of 3D.
I don't know. I know it was released on Laserdisc in Japan in 3D. So
Well, if they release that, then they're going to have to release Jaws 3D, and I don't want that to happen.
Amityville 3D is just about...
I have a 3D version of that, too. It's really hard to watch.
Amityville 3D, I just got to walk a mile, and there's my Amityville 3D, okay?
That's right. You live in Amityville, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Lucky. What Friday the 13th film do you consider the best representation of the series as a whole?
I would say either Part 1 or Part 4.
For me, 4.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I would say 4, too.
And I only pick Part 1 just because of the flow. I mean, of course, when you think of Friday the 13th, you're going to think of Jason. But as a kid, that was the one that I watched first, I believe. And that's the one that I liked first. And then all the rest came after.
Yeah, I actually have to go with 4, too, just because I'm a big Savini mark.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Aside from the death scenes of the film, which were all great, you know, that was almost as close as you could get to the first one with a Jason, almost. It was like...
The other thing I liked about 4 was that I didn't know who was going to survive in that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the other ones, even the ones before it, the ones after, I mean, you kind of knew who was going to be, you know, the sole survivor, because they kind of set it up early.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 4, you see the kids, they kind of focused on one, and it was like, well, is she going to make it? And then you have the family next door.
Yeah, and then Rob comes up, and you're like, wow, he's definitely going to survive, and
he
gets fucked up.
And he even set that up. I know some people kind of was like, well, what purpose did he have? It's like, well, it's kind of set up. Maybe there's, like, an opponent for Jason. I don't know, maybe he'll... And then he just, like, the moment he sees him, he's just, he's killing me! And I was like, oh, well, he didn't last.
Yeah.
So.
I forgot who pointed this out, but there's one part where when they first meet up with Rob, you see the foot, you know, the footstep, or actually his feet come up, and it's actually Jason's feet if you know, look at the boots and look at the pants, and then it you know, cuts to Rob's. So I thought that was really, really well done. I didn't even notice that until, like, last year. And
I would agree with you guys, though, about part 4. I think it was right when they knew exactly what formula they had to use, and they just never strayed away from that until... Well, part 8, I guess.
Yeah. Well, also with part 4, I mean, they originally, when Paramount did it, they basically made up their minds and they're doing, this is going to be the last one.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and plus you had, I think, probably the best director to do the film in Zito, although I kind of contradict that, being Miner did a great job in the previous ones, but it's just basically, I think they just went balls out and just said, let's do whatever the hell we can on this one. And having Savini back, of course, definitely helped.
Oh, yeah.
But, I want to ask you guys, because I know you guys like part 5 a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't. I kind of do. I'm just wondering, what is it about part 5 that appeals to you so much? Because I know a lot of people don't like it because they say that's not Jason.
Well, we're big fans of comedy and horror. And to me, the best duo ever is Ethel and Junior.
I agree with that.
Okay, in addition to that, though, you also have Demon and Nita singing to each other as he's shitting, like, what is it, tacos or something?
Enchiladas. Honestly, yeah, that's probably the thing. I think it's the most entertaining of the Jason films to watch because of the comedy.
There's actually pretty cool death scenes.
Yeah,
and
the characters are so over the top, and I think I'm not sure if they were meant to be that over the top, but it just works that way for me because they're so, like, overacting all the roles and stuff. It's just hilarious for me to watch. A lot of people bitch about that film because it wasn't supposed to be the real Jason. You know, it was Roy who was the killer in the film.
Which never bothered me at all.
But,
at least it wasn't Jason going from body to body.
Yeah, which is a much worse concept, I have to say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that it probably has more to do with the characters in that film than it does with Jason. And
a lot of nudity, too, which is always good.
Yeah, and probably the best nude scene in any of the films.
I like that movie a lot for a lot of reasons, but I like the fact that it wasn't Jason because it changed it around. It made you know think it was Jason, but you know a lot of people point out some obvious things that pointed away from him. But when I was a little kid, I thought it was Jason. But I like the humor a lot in it. But to me, it just had a really good flow. I liked the flow in it a lot, and it had a lot of comedy in it, and it had a lot of good deaths. But you know. It's really, really hard to point to what I really like in that movie. And
well, the scene where...
It's definitely the one I watched the most.
It's about
the most rewatchability, I think.
Yeah, something about the scenes in that movie that you can just go back and rewatch them again, and it never gets old. Like the scene where Vic's chopping the wood. just stuff like that is just... To me, I don't know, hilarious. I might be sick, but it's just...
I just feel it's still missing something. I mean, I tried watching it again, and there are a lot of things I like about it. I don't know. Maybe in my opinion, I think maybe they should have given a little bit more time on it. I mean, the overall film does have a feeling of being rushed.
It was. I'll tell you this though. I have all the Fangorias from that time when you know the fan feedback and stuff. It was definitely hated when it first was released.
Yeah.
I know that. So, you know, you're not alone. A lot of people hate the movie.
Yeah. But
one thing I did notice in the movie, and a couple kills that I noticed, the shirt that the killer is wearing is green, and of course Roy is wearing the blue jumpsuit, so I think they kind of, I don't know if they're trying to mislead the audience, I'm sure they were, but I don't know if it was just intentional or just bad continuity. But
the one thing that always sticks to me from that movie, though, that I don't like, and I was going to talk about this anyway, was the whole Dick Wine thing that happened after that, which was that for a long time he was signing a lot of autographs as the guy that played Jason, when everybody knows Tom Morga was the main guy.
He's a good Jason.
Yeah, Tom Morga wasn't even credited, was he?
No, I don't think so. For a long time, most people thought it was Dick Wine.
It's kind of like the Warrington and Dash.
Yeah, it's exactly like that, actually. Yeah, but that's the one thing that I always remember from that movie that I just never liked that at all.
Well, Eric Nash from Crystal Lake, CampCrystalLake.com, he mentioned to me that Tom Morga said there was two other people that played Jason in the movie.
Yeah, there's
Yeah, there's in the opening scene that was shot after you know the principal photography was done, and they just got some random guy to play that. And when Roy actually fell onto the spikes, that was yet another star.
Well, one thing I did like about Five though is I thought it had one of the best performances in a series, which was John Shepard.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Tommy.
Yeah.
He definitely had an intensity in that part, and one of the things I think. You know, maybe if I think if they would have tried to make it look more like it was Tommy doing it, because I one of the things I will say, it definitely had one of the better endings in terms of the very ending where he basically becomes Jason.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets enthralled by it. And also, I don't know, do you think maybe the fact that you guys like it is because 1 and 5 are probably the ones most etched in reality? Because it's like, you know, pretty much once he died, he became a zombie. And he kind of lost all belief after that.
Well, I'm probably actually more of a fan of zombie Jason than I am of, I don't know what it is, hydrocephalic Jason or mongoloid Jason or inbred Jason or any of those. But for that film, for, you know, for the Five and everything, where it really wasn't supposed to be Jason, I like this performance of Tom Morga playing Jason, and I also like the fact that he was just supposed to be a normal guy. You know, it wasn't really supposed to be some deformity.
And it was also a little bit of a change of setting, too. It wasn't by a lake or anything. It was like a halfway house.
Yeah, the story was also a lot like Part 1 with, you know, you have a parent with a retarded son who gets killed, and then, of course, he or she flips out and, you know, takes revenge. I think in a way that it's a lot like Part 1 in that aspect, but I don't even know if I would even say it was any like any of the ones before it, because to me it has a completely different feel, but I like the feeling. I like the where it's at. I like the characters. I mean, just about every character in that movie was likable, even if they were only on set for a couple seconds.
But
at least set
up a lot of good characters.
Yeah. How do you feel about, you guys feel about this, though? The change of, like, the Tommy Jarvis character from, I think it was Corey Feldman, then it was John Shepard, then it was Tom Matthews.
Yeah.
I was just curious, out of those three guys, you know, what do you think about those?
I think going from Corey Feldman to John Shepard was more realistic, because that's about how, you know, someone would be after enduring what you know, Corey Feldman or Tommy had to do in Part 4.
Yeah.
I didn't like the Tommy in Part 6.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't think that he was convincing. I guess, you know, according to the timelines, he was, I think, like 19 or something, 17, something like that. He just didn't look that young. And he was a little more, he just didn't seem like he was disturbed at all. You know, he had a couple flashbacks at the first of it, and after that he was, you know, pretty much good to go.
I think Corey Feldman was originally going to be in the fifth one, but he had to film Goonies.
Yeah, and when I read, John Shepard was supposed to be in Part 6, and he actually was considering taking it, and then he decided not to because he was, I may be wrong on this, but I believe he was a youth minister, and he was telling, you know, the people that he was counseling, don't watch these movies, and he just felt like a big hypocrite. I believe I read that in the Slick Memories.
It's in one of the books. It's also on, I also read that on the website just today.
Yeah.
As well. I don't know, 6 to me was just a flat-out comedy.
Oh, yeah, it was meant to be.
So I think maybe if, I mean, you had the Tommy connection, which was okay, but considering it kind of 6 went on almost like 5 never happened.
Yeah,
yeah.
In a sense, so it kind of just I would have liked to have seen a continuation.
Yeah, I think
definitely would have.
Because it bombed at the box office, they really just wanted to go back to what worked. So.
Yeah, what's even funnier is I believe A New Beginning is a lot better than Jason Lives.
I mean, it was funny because 6 was one of the ones I didn't like when I first saw it, but lately I've come to like it a little bit more.
Yeah, that was actually the first one that I ever got to see.
Yeah, I think all of them, like, if you watch them enough, you get to the point where you can watch them. Like, I used to hate Jason Goes to Hell. I watched it once, and then I watched it, like, 3 or 4 times in the last couple of years because I think the movie has a really good flow when Jason's not in the scenes, I think.
Honestly, the only one of those movies I can't watch anymore is Jason X.
Yeah, I think I watched that movie twice.
I
mainly have the DVD only for the Jason Voorhees documentary.
Yeah, that is worth the DVD.
Well, I downloaded the movie, and I hated it, but I got the DVD for like $2 on Amazon used. So.
You talk about a movie that felt absolutely generic, though. Jason X, that was just, didn't even feel like a Friday the 13th movie at all for some reason. And it, you know, you talk about it was a good idea to move the place to a, you know, a therapy home or whatever that was, residential treatment or whatever. But to move it up into a space shuttle or whatever that was, it just felt so sterile and generic,
yeah.
And you just couldn't.
You know, for a mongoloid inbred killer who drowned at 11, he really gets around. I mean, he's been in more places than I have. What's up with that?
Yeah.
He's been a man. Well, I live near Manhattan, but he's been, like, been everywhere. He's been space, Manhattan. And
wasn't most of that film, like, with using Canadian actors and stuff, too?
Yeah, yeah.
See, that's yeah. All those films, for some reason, that are made up mostly around Toronto, I think.
I did like seeing Cronenberg and Jason X, though. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I like
to kill Cronenberg.
I like Cronenberg anyway.
Yeah.
The beginning of it.
Okay, I'm just going to ask something. This is really, it'll probably be really short, but what is the worst Jason and the best Jason, you think?
I'm going to be really biased because I have a favorite, which is Richard Brooker, although I don't think that he really did really well, like, with the stunt aspect. I mean, he did really well. He just didn't do as good as Kane Hodder did because Kane Hodder took a lot of falls and,
yeah.
You know, almost killed himself a few times. So I would say either, it's really hard because even Dash, I mean, he had his finger chopped off, well, literally chopped off, and broke his ribs. But I would say Kane Hodder because he did a lot more with his body and took a lot more falls. And I would say the stunt side of it, Kane Hodder, but as for, like, my favorite, it'd be Richard Brooker.
Yeah.
Right, I'm in agreement with Hodder on the stunts. Plus, I also think Kane's a really cool guy. But for me, performance-wise, I think the best was Ted White in 4.
Yeah.
Only because, and I watched 4 again recently, and he's still, the way he just pops up in 4, it just, in a way, just the way he moves around just still scares me. It still gives me a little chill watching it.
It's so hard to pick.
Yeah, the Texas Dolly swagger he's got.
Yeah.
And even, like, the worst, I mean, I would have to go with Ken Kersinger.
Yeah, I was going to say Ken Kersinger as a joke, but.
Yeah, or I could say Warrington Gillette.
Yeah,
I don't think we should give him the benefit of naming him because he seems like a real asshole.
Yeah,
I hope he's not listening.
No, I'm sure he's not. He doesn't care about the fans. So.
No.
As far as the best, I would definitely say Kane Hodder just because of what, you know, not only his stunt work, but I just thought he did this thing that none of the other Jason did where he just had this really heavy breathing thing going, like right when he got. Right before he killed people, he would get all, like, hulked up or something.
Yeah.
And that was just really menacing looking, you know. You can't really talk. If you're Jason, you can't do anything else. So he kind of came up with that, and I thought that was kind of unique. To where it looked like he was going to kill you. Like, he's getting ready to do it.
It definitely was unique, and I think he added a lot to the Part 7 Jason because he was behind so many prosthetics. I agree with you with that one, but I'm not a fan of breathing zombies, so it's really weird about that.
I don't even think they knew he was going to be a zombie then.
Yeah, I don't even think he was. I guess he's just the living dead, I guess. Not necessarily a zombie.
He's just flexing his zombie muscles.
As far as the worst, though, it'd definitely be Ken Kersinger because he didn't really do anything.
He didn't. I mean,
and he's just a big dude that they got because of his height, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think it's bullshit that he ain't going to play Jason in Freddy versus Jason. You know. He was one of the only people that for, like, 10 years was, you know, trying to get that movie made.
Yeah. Because Hodder became so identifiable with the role, even though the Friday films he did weren't exactly the most popular ones.
Yeah, see, I really didn't like how he did Part 8. And of course, Part 9 he was barely in, and Part 10 I just thought he was really robotic. But he's not my favorite Jason because of the 3 that he did that I really hate. But at the same time, I'm kind of like 50-50 on him doing Freddy versus Jason. I think he could have did a hell of a lot better than
Yeah, I do agree there. I do agree there.
he said a lot of mean things, like he deserved the role, which I guess in a way he does, but unfortunately it's business and shit like that happens. And
I think Herzinger was only picked because he's like 6'8" or something like that.
Yeah, he's definitely really tall.
I mean, it was the contrast between him and Frey. Like, they wanted like a towering monster to show, like, I guess, the difference in them, I guess. I don't know.
And it seems like they didn't even really look for anybody because, you know, Herzinger, he is a Canadian stuntman. He was in Part 8. And I just think they could have found a lot better tall people.
I sort of agree with you, though, about Richard Brooker. He had a sort of like a swagger to him that was really creepy, I thought, in that movie.
He just, to me, felt like someone who he just knew that these people are fucked, and he didn't even have to run, you know what I mean? He ran, but he just pretty much waited for them to come to him, or just waited for them to
there's the scene on the dock where he shoots with them.
Yeah.
And back was always really creepy.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that, actually.
I'd actually kind of agree with the Ted White thing, though, because I honestly do think that that guy, just because of, you know, the way he was personally, and that kind of, he was a big shit-kicking Texan guy, just had that swagger about him that made him look like he was really going to kick somebody's ass, and it didn't matter, you know, that he was in a Jason outfit.
There was also one scene in Part 6 that C.J. Graham did that was really, really effective, and I think it was one of the pickup shots that they did that they wanted more kills was when he's killing the graveyard employee.
Yeah.
And, like, the guy's watching from the side, and he lifts up his machete, and then he just turns and sees him. It's just like, that to me is just like the point of view. It's like, you see something like that, and then they see that you're there.
Yeah, that
was very, very well done.
Yeah, no matter what you're doing, if you're watching someone when you're not supposed to be, whether they're, you know, playing with yourself or whatever, and that happens, it's the worst feeling in the world.
Oh, yeah. that was captured pretty well. I mean, for what was supposed to be like a throwaway scene, just like a pickup scene.
Yeah.
That was very, very well done.
I guess a good question would be, out of all of the Fridays, you know, I started watching them when I was really young because I had a lot older of a brother who would rent them, and we lived in the middle of nowhere, so we would rent a VCR because we couldn't afford one, and then we'd get 5 free rentals with a VCR rental for a week. But anyways, as a kid, there was a lot of scenes that I couldn't get out of my head. I was wondering if there was any, you know, any certain scene that you guys couldn't forget, or just, you know, you had nightmares of.
You mean
coming
like
out of the water in Part 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
That to me, still, for me personally, I that's one of the scariest scenes ever in film.
You're talking about kill scenes, right?
Any
scene?
Much,
If you're talking about any scene in particular.
Debbie Sue Voorhees.
Yeah, definitely. As a kid.
For another reason.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The first thing that popped in my mind when you said that, though, was the tourniquet scene in Part 5 where he tightens, like, the thing on the guy's eyes. I don't know why that is, but I always remember that even after I saw it. That's one of those things I guess I couldn't get out of my head.
For me, it was in Part 3 right at the end because I thought the movie was over, and it was the first time I ever watched it, and I think I was maybe like 8 or 9. And when he popped up in the window at the end, I almost flew off my couch, and for like 3 weeks after that, I was having nightmares, and I lived on a farm, so we had this barn behind our house, and I was just terrified to go around it because of that. But,
yeah, another scene that I thought about a lot, and eventually, unfortunately, it came to fruition in a really horrible movie, but was the scene at the end of Jason Goes to Hell where the Freddy glove comes up and grabs the hockey man.
That was like the ultimate tease.
Yeah, at the time, I thought that was like the greatest thing ever.
Oh, yeah, for everybody it was.
Yeah, when I first saw that, I was like, there's no way it's ever going to happen. They're just doing that because they can, because it's a new line. And, I never thought it would get made.
Yeah, lucky us.
Yeah. And now hearing the Freddy versus Jason versus Ash, I just don't want to think about that.
Versus Ghoulies.
Yeah.
I think a good one would be maybe like Gremlins versus Ghoulies or Troll versus Ghoulies.
Munchies versus Ghoulies.
Yeah. Or maybe Ghoulies Go to College versus Troll 2.
Yeah. Ghoulies versus Critters versus Troll 2.
Yeah.
But
versus Dolly Dearest.
Versus Demonic Toys and Puppet Mask.
You know, just going back to the franchise, I mean, to the whole series in particular. I mean, one of the things I liked about 4 was, you said one of the things, Wes, you said one of the things you liked about 5 was that you liked the characters in it and they were likable.
Mm-hmm.
Which of all the characters did you find the most likable that you really didn't want to see killed?
In part four?
In all of the films.
Oh, in all of them. Oh, well. I would say, that's really hard. I would say Rick, maybe, because I felt bad for him. Just, maybe not Rick. I don't know. It's so hard. I would say maybe, I always felt, well, one of the things with part five was that I felt bad when, was it Joey got killed?
Yeah.
He was
just
trying to help,
that kind of set the whole tone.
Yeah.
But one of the things I like about four was that there were likable and believable characters. I always like Crispin Glover's.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite
portrayal.
Actors, so.
You know, he definitely had a likable characteristic in him. And when he died, and he died so quickly.
Yeah.
In a film, it was like without even warning.
Yeah, I might say Shelley in part three because, you know, I guess I sort of relate to him a little bit.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
One that never made sense to me, I guess, and I kind of like, it always kind of bothered me that it was never shown, I don't think, but it was implied, was it was part four and the mother was killed.
Oh, Joan Freeman.
Joan Freeman.
Yeah, there was a scene where she was in a bathtub,
yeah,
like her eyes were white. Yeah, it's like a snippet of it in the trailer.
Yeah.
They never showed her die, though, did they? It was just...
No, in Crystal Lake Memories, they do have a picture of her in her makeup when she died. They just never shot it. Actually, Joseph Zito cut that out because he just didn't think it was
proper. I actually like the fact it is cut out because it does leave a lot more of the imagination.
Oh, definitely does.
Yeah, but I just thought that was, I don't know, needless, maybe, and it just always bothered me.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I didn't even think she died. I just thought, you know, at first, I just thought, you know, maybe it was Tommy and his sister coming back up, and they startle her because it never really had anything. And I, you know, as a little kid, you don't really think too much about things like that. But that was really one that kind of bothered me, too.
Mm.
Okay.
One last thing I want to ask. Do you guys ever think that uncut box set will ever come out from like Paramount?
From Paramount, probably not.
Or if someone like Anchor Bay, if they bought the rights, which I don't know if even Paramount does that, but...
I don't know. I'm kind of surprised some of the stuff that Anchor Bay gets. So I wouldn't be surprised. I'm kind of hoping somebody buys the Hellraiser franchise from Dimension. So I don't know. I would like to see that. Yeah, I definitely would. I've heard a lot of things about 3 uncut.
Yeah,
especially with the 3 endings.
Yeah. And part 7 has a ton of cuts.
Yeah. You know, I remember seeing that. I remember Kane Hodder at conventions would show that tape. And the tape on the box set really doesn't do it justice. I remember seeing a clearer copy of everything. I guess after the years, you know, probably the damage done to that tape, but very, very effective kills on that one.
Yeah, I don't, as far as Paramount goes, no, I'd probably say not, because they don't have a real good relationship with horror movies for some reason.
And they never respected the franchise when they were doing them to begin with.
No, I mean, they just thought, what was the budget on those? Less than $1 million, usually?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll ever happen. I mean, definitely with Paramount, it's probably never going to happen. And I would also be curious, I mean, what footage is left? Because, I mean, they were negative pickups. I mean, who knows who has the cut footage?
I personally think they have it. I think they just...
I'm hoping they do. I mean, you know, I'd like to think they do, but I just... very pessimistic about it because it hasn't happened yet.
Paramount really don't know what they have, I don't think. I mean... I think if the uncut box set was released, it would probably be one of, if not the horror release of the year. You know?
Oh, it definitely would be. It would be definitely probably a decade. I mean, easily for me.
Yeah. Plus, they got like 10 versions of Evil Dead out. They can have one definitive version of Friday 13.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if there's one good thing to remake, you know, if you know they decide to remake this, is maybe it will draw interest in having an uncut version.
That's true. It probably would draw interest in putting out more, you know, the older stuff they might think about doing after the remake.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, hopefully if it is remade and it does really well, that will happen. But part two is the one that I really want to see uncut because of all the kills in there that I read was cut out. I mean, there's a lot of really, really good. I mean, of course, it's only a couple seconds here and there, but it just seemed like it was really, really good. It's stuff cut out. And then, of course, part five, I mean, pretty much every kill is off screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're almost off screen.
I guess we can hope to see it. You know, I don't know if it'll happen, but we can dream, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, someone had the picture, so I'm hoping someone has the footage.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of feel the same way on that one.
And, you know, with My Bloody Valentine, I mean, they have the cut footage of that. It's known, and they're not doing anything with it. That's what just really upsets me, that things like that happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense if they would at least release the footage to a company that would do something with it.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right, I just actually just thought of a question. If you guys had an opportunity to restart the franchise or do another one, where would you go with it? What would be, like, the central story with it?
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's hard. But
I've
read so many on the forums, and actually a lot of them are actually better than so many ideas that I heard.
Yeah. From a lot of the fan stuff, the fan fiction stuff, that is a lot better than the movies that got made recently.
I mean, I know the overall consensus is that Freddy vs. Jason was pretty negative, but I remember there was a draft going around that began with Jason in court. I mean, because I can only imagine how that would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Jason X kind of did it a little bit with their opening scene, but I can't see him in court.
No. There was a couple drafts of that movie that I read that I just thought was horrible.
Yeah. So that's why I'm kind of, I mean, it's like, I mean, I kind of like Freddy vs. Jason because I just really wanted to watch the shit out of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I was happy.
It's okay to watch and everything, but you can just tell it was something that, I don't know, I mean, if you're waiting 10 years on a movie and that's the best you can do, I mean, that's the way I felt about it, you know.
Yeah, the first time I watched that in the theaters, I was really happy with it. I thought it was really fun. But then after that, I bought the movie, and I hadn't even watched it all the way through since then. And it's just really hard to watch.
Yeah,
I'm pretty much in agreement there.
I think, though, I would go back to basics. You know, I mean, I wouldn't try to put too much of a plot in there because, you know, the movies that I like, the plot really isn't there.
Yeah, you really don't need one.
I think they need to get it back to a point. And I was actually talking with you guys know Chris Garitano about this.
Yeah.
And Jason just needs to be scary again.
Yeah.
And, you know, the part with the later films is that you kind of know where he's coming from. You know where he's going to be. It's all set up. And, you know, one of the most effective things about the earlier films is the fact that, you know, the character was believable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the inbred four.
He was definitely believable, and he also was believable to the point where, like in part 6, 7, 8, Jason was just, you know, he's like a lawnmower. He just goes at people.
He was just indestructible. And in the first four, he felt pain.
Yeah, he felt pain. He was terrified.
Well, that's where it stands right now, though. So, I mean, he's basically a corpse now, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So what do you do from there? I mean, I guess one thing you could do, if they're going to do a remake anyway and you want to just do a sequel, and if I was doing it, I would just scrap the whole idea of the corpse. Because that's probably what they'll do anyway when they remake it, so what does it matter? I mean, they never really followed a plot anyway, so why start now? And I would bring in a cast of complete unknowns. I'd bring in a stunt man to play him that, you know, basically had a background similar to probably Tom Morgan that was in the business for a long time before that. Did a lot of westerns and stuff like that. And I would have it be just almost, you know, bring it back to the camp and have it be like the old movies were. I mean,
yeah.
Pretty basic, but
yeah.
It's probably get Nicotero.
Yeah.
Or at least somebody from KMB and no friggin' CGI.
They really didn't need to spend $25 million on Freddy vs. Jason.
No.
I mean, on the one hand, I was glad it made a lot of money in its first week because it really brought back the genre in a way.
It definitely did.
You know, because I remember they were saying that it was only going to make like maybe 10, 15 million. And I remember when it came out, I'm like, so many people are waiting for this. It's going to have a huge opening, and I was glad it did.
Yeah, it was actually the last movie that we went to down here that was pretty much packed. You know, the whole theater was sold out, I believe.
Yeah. Everybody was waiting for it. I remember it was one of the few times that I've gone to a theater where there was it felt like a rock concert outside.
Oh, yeah.
There were so many people who were just waiting. They were just like, you know, oh, we're going to see these two guys fuck each other up.
Yeah.
It also opened up the genre, or not the genre, but the franchise to a lot of people who never seen any of the movies before then.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of surprising that it's been like over 3 years now, and you know, I figured for sure they would have another one out the next year after it made some money.
I was thinking like almost, you know, like 12 months from that point. I mean, the way they're doing with Saw, you know, that's what I expected. But during the supposed Freddy versus Jason versus Ash treatment that was floating around,
No, I
don't really want to. It actually is pretty interesting. I'm sure
it would work on a novelty standpoint, but I would never take it seriously as a film.
With Freddy vs. Jason, though, the way they ended that movie, it just sincerely pissed me off because what is the point of having somebody like that? But you know you can't kill them.
Yeah.
You know that there's no way that they're both basically indestructible, which is not the way the series, and either one of those series started out.
Yeah.
And now they're basically, you know, immortal. So what's the point of having any good guy? You know they're going to lose. I just don't understand.
Yeah, but they kind of make it, if you want to get in terms of, like, you know, they kind of promoted the film as if, you could have had Vince McMahon kind of produce the film. And it was like, you know, if you want to do that, they kind of, in the film, promoted Jason as kind of the good guy of it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like, well, he still kills people.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess maybe they want to throw an actual protagonist, I guess, battle them that you can root for the sequel. Maybe that's why they want to bring in Ash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't know why not go the whole way and bring in, like, you know, Michael Myers, too.
Have a big battle royal.
Yeah, it's like a three-way dance and then the tag match.
Yeah, why not? I mean, they've been doing that pretty much since, what, the 40s?
Yeah.
Frankenstein, the Wolfman, yeah, why not? One of the things I really like about the franchise in particular now is that people still talk about it all these years later. And because I remember the impact. I mean, I was like 7, 8 years old when some of these sequels came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm almost 30 now, and it's just really cool seeing, like, I'm trying to introduce my 12-year-old nephew to it for the first time, and he's just, you know, I just see him with, like, a Jason shirt on. I just think it's, like, the coolest thing. But, you know, it's just really cool that the franchise it's cool that it's still going on after all these years.
Yeah, I think the franchise this franchise introduced more people to horror movies than any other, I'd say.
Yeah, and that's what it did for me. I mean, it introduced me into movies like The Burning, which I really love. It's one of my favorite movies. And then even movies that come out before this, like Black Christmas, I mean, it opened me up to movies like that. Because when I was little, the only horror movies I really watched was like The Exorcist or Hell Night was one of the first ones I've ever watched. But it really opened me up to the franchise, because once I saw one, I had to watch all of them, and watch them, you know, like 3 or 4 times in a row, some of them, and then it opened me up to the horror genre, which, I mean, as a kid, I mean, I really didn't know what I liked. It's just after seeing these movies, I knew I liked horror movies, and I was 9 back then, now I'm 30, and I've been watching them ever since, and the movies really worked to the point that they're easy to like movies. I mean, not many people can watch them and say, oh, you know, these movies suck. You know, a lot of people claim, you know, the directing's bad or the writing's bad, but that doesn't matter because it has so much going for them. Yeah. And
it just had the perfect, I'm sorry to interrupt, it just had the perfect formula. And so many other people tried to copy, and it just didn't work.
And it's just a simple formula. You seclude a bunch of teens, you know, put them somewhere where they can't get help, and then you kill them off one by one.
Yeah, most people knew exactly what they were getting into
when
you went and saw the Friday 13th film, which is what they liked about it.
Yeah.
No surprises.
And, you know, a lot of times the movies, right after another, were a lot like the movie before, like as for like the plot and formula, and that's what I went to see. That's what I wanted to see.
Well, plus I also think it says a lot, you know, there's a lot of independent filmmakers who are casting Friday the 13th alumni in their films. I mean, I can easily think of Scott Goldberg came back, Paul, and I just saw a short at the Rhode Island Horror Film Festival last week, Penny Dreadful with Betsy Palmer and Warrington Gillette. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I think Sega's Playground had
Ron Mielke.
Yeah, Ron Mielke.
Yeah, Ron Mielke. So
that was a great film, by the way.
Yeah, it was.
It was great.
And, you know, I mean, there's a reason why they're being looked at, because we're all fans of the genre.
And you also look at these actors. I mean, like Paul Kratka, he hasn't acted since Friday the 13th. And the day they came back, the night they came back, which I forgot which one he was in. But he did a really good job in it. And, you know, these people would just get overlooked because back then, I mean, they were typecasted. It was really hard for him to get a job acting. And, of course, he quit. But, I mean, they're really good actors.
Yeah, but as long as they're fans and then the fans turn into independent filmmakers and, you know, try to seek out some of these people they grew up watching the films with, which is kind of the best part about how this is working out, you know, right now.
Well, maybe you know, I should look at it and maybe, you know,
instead of looking at a music video director for me at this point, you know.
Well, yeah.
Which are good. Some are really good. Some are really good. There are a lot of really good directors out there, but maybe they should look at the independents and really get somebody who has a good knack of the series. Maybe that's what hurt Freddy vs. Jason, because Ronnie Yu didn't know about the series.
I definitely think they should probably just completely stick with the independent filmmakers when trying to find another one.
I think it all has to go with the writers as well. I mean, with the older movies, a lot of the writers didn't like the films. They didn't want to write for the films. Yeah. They just did it for a paycheck. And, I mean, I don't think it really hurt the movies at all. I mean, some of them were really poorly written. But nowadays, it's so easy to get a good writer. And someone who would be willing to do it, you know, as back then they wouldn't do it because they didn't want to be typecasted as a horror writer. So I think it's got a lot to do with the directing and the writing, because some of the writing of these movies are just horrible. And
let's not leave out the gore aspect either.
Yeah, the gore.
You really can't get away with doing that stuff they did in the 80s. Plus, if you do it now, it's mostly CG. It looks horrible. Yeah.
To a point. I agree with that, and I sort of disagree with it, because there are... I'm not really a huge fan of seeing CG. It depends on where it works. It doesn't belong in horror films, for sure.
I don't think it belongs in independent films, either.
No.
You've seen, like, a lot of the CG in independents. Yeah.
I mean, part of, you know, but that's one of the biggest aspects of why the series worked, is because it all looked realistic. The violence in it, I don't know. It depends. I mean, some CGI can work.
I mean, like what I already mentioned in prior roundtables, I believe, where, you know, making bullet holes look like they go all the way through, or, you know, things like that. But in horror movies especially, I don't think it's really needed. It can be used, and it can look good if it's done right with, you know, practical effects. But it you know, in the 80s, they didn't have CG and a lot of the stuff. You just got to get a good person to do it, like K&B, who do it and make it look real.
Also, in the original Friday the 13th, and even some of the sequels, some of the kills were done on screen. You'd see the knife going in, but there would be like a quick cutaway. But I remember in the first one in particular, with the exception of the arrow through the throat, pretty much most of the other kills were you didn't really see the kills. You saw the after effect of
it,
which is very effective.
Oh yeah,
and a lot of people today. One of the things about the new chainsaw is, like, I think they tried to show too much.
Oh, yeah.
You know, without giving it away for you guys, but it was just, I mean, it looked good, but it's like, you know, it couldn't get the same reaction not showing it being done to showing the after effect.
It's best if you're going to show it that people not know it's coming. Now, I think that's the problem with movies like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because they just, you know, when some guy's running towards you with a chainsaw, that he's what's going to happen. With the first movie, like with the Kevin Bacon kill, he's just laying in bed and kind of...
That was good directing, because it was, you know, bringing you away from that, you know, making you focus up top, just like Sean Cunningham was saying. And I think that's what you need. You need a good director that can do that.
Good luck with that.
I mean, if they really want to make a profit, you know, I mean, the first film didn't even cost $1 million. You could use the same formula, but less than that, you're going to have a huge opening anyway.
Yeah.
You're going to have you're going to get at least $20 million.
It's
pretty much a no-brainer. I mean, the poster of Freddy versus Jason was just a picture of Jason, picture of Freddy, versus in the middle, and that made $36 million. So,
If
you call it Friday the 13th, that's all they really want anyway.
Exactly.
And even with reviews, you can get all the bad reviews you want, and people aren't going to care, because I definitely don't care, because I know.
Well, I mean, horror movies never get good reviews.
No, they definitely don't. No. And you go to places, you know, you watch Siskel and Ebert, or Ebert and Roper, or whoever's on there now, and every movie I like, they seem to, you know, put it down. So I definitely don't listen to people like that.
And every movie I don't like, they seem to love.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely, you know, hey, look, we all know this. A lot of people don't understand the true meaning of the genre. So, whatever, tough shit.
It's definitely the most lucrative genre out there. I mean, you can literally make a movie for nothing and make a lot from it. And I think that's why I think that's why they should at least give more respect to them, like Paramount. I mean, they can make a movie for like $8 million and make, you know, even if they make $30 million, it's a success. then there's movies that are made for $110 million, and if they don't make $300 million back, you know, the people are getting fired left and right. So I just don't understand why they don't give more respect to these films and do more of them.
You know what? Fuck it. Why don't we just go ahead and just remake Armageddon? Let them know how to do it. You know?
I'd like to thank Scott Perry, Colonel
Scott Perry,
and Scab Boy. If you want to check out their website, Scott Perry's website is slickdevilentertainment.com, mm-hmm. and you can check out Scab Boy's site at scabboy.net.
Okay.
And if you need any proof of how big this big of a fan this guy is,
uh-huh.
go to his site and check out his collection of Friday the 13th stuff.
The guy quite possibly has the most Friday the 13th memorabilia and autographs I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. So it's quite the sight to see, folks, especially if you're big memorabilia fans like us.
So speaking of fans and fans in general, now we're going to take the fan mail portion of the show.
That's right.
And it's just overflowing this week once again with fan mail. And we're going to go ahead and read that for you. So go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I could read the fan mail since, you know, you got the laryngitis. Shit.
Whatever.
This first question comes to us from Darkstar. It says, thanks for reading my questions, and I love part two of the Angus Scream interview. It says, you have the chance to feed a well-known horror movie actor, director, or producer's toes first into a wood chipper while you hit them in the testicles with a hammer at the same time. It's interesting. To make this tough, the person cannot be Eli Roth or Bruce Campbell. Who would you choose?
Andrew Bernarski.
Yeah, Jonathan Liebsman probably for me right now.
Yeah, that'd be two of the people involved in the new Texas Chainsaw prequel, which we haven't seen. We probably will see it this weekend.
Yeah, if not those two guys, and just for old time's sake, Richard Rubenstein.
Yeah.
So that would be who I would choose.
That was from our good friend Darkstar.
Yeah. We're not fans of people fucking over George Romero. Okay, next question comes to us from Vampire. He says, Stephen King's Nightmares and Dreamscapes is starting on UK television. Is it worth watching?
I've never seen it.
I'll say no, and I haven't even seen it. I have no idea. I haven't seen the damn thing, but I would imagine if you judge by like his last 3 or 4 miniseries, probably not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I saw previews for it. It just didn't seem like anything that would interest me that much.
Okay.
We can't really answer that, though. Neither of us have seen it. So.
I can answer it just based on prior experiences with this one.
Yeah.
But, okay. Here's one from El Juan.
El Juan.
El Juan Grupe. It says, given that Halloween is almost here, I wanted to ask you guys this question. If you had to pick one film that put you in the mood for Halloween, what would it be and why that film? For example, I've watched Dawn of the Dead every Halloween for the last 16 years. I think I have too. For me, it just isn't Halloween without it.
Halloween?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I think we watch Halloween every year too.
Yeah.
Or some form of Halloween, you know, Halloween 2 or Halloween. And I think I watch Dawn of the Dead every year too.
Like you watch Dawn of the Dead like every month.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Those two movies probably always get you in the mood for Halloween. I don't know. What else would you think? I know we watch a lot of Romero movies in general around Halloween. Day of the Dead. Or
Martin was one we watched last year, I think. I would say Phantasm is another one that sort of has that mood to it that, you know.
Trick or Treat.
Yeah, that's true.
Skippy in it.
You know, any of the Carrie is another one that has like a autumn vibe to it.
Yeah, it does.
I don't know. There's like.
It seems to me, though, that there are certain films that are always on Halloween, like around Halloween. And
Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead's one of them, yeah. Psycho, it seems to be always on. And this is usually on AMC or something like that.
Yeah, they have a lot of the monster movies on, too. Like,
yeah.
What was the one that came from outer space? Was another one?
There's a lot of them that they have on those channels. They have that Fright Fest stuff. But. Yeah, those would be some of the choices. But we just recently, by the way, had our first, it's like a Halloween horror film festival that we had.
2 or 3 nights in October. I can tell you about, I guess we can talk about some of the movies we watched. We'll be reviewing 3 of them next week.
Mm-hmm.
We watched 5 movies, I'm thinking.
Yeah, we didn't get to 6. Not this year.
Don't Go in the House was one.
Which was just crappily classic.
Yeah, it was. It was like there's not too many slasher movies that involves actually burning the victims.
Yeah, like a giant stove contraption. Yeah. Then we watched Effects.
Which, yeah, anybody is tricked into buying this like me, be really mad because, you know, it's the cover of it actually looks like it'll be freaking like a killer slasher sort of movie with, Joe Pilato is in it.
Yeah, Savini.
Tom Savini, and John Harrison is actually in it, who's a pretty big-time director now, and he was in Dawn of the Dead. And, you know, it's not what you think at all, and I think it was unreleased for like 25 years until last year.
And probably should have stayed.
Yeah, it should have stayed unreleased.
The thing about it is, it's kind of the unhinged syndrome where they make the boxes and, you know, shit look really good, then the movie's absolutely horrible.
And we actually watched Feast.
Yeah, the new one by John Gulager, and that was...
We'll be talking about that next week. We saw the new Texas Chainsaw
remastered version
DVD
of
the Dark Sky.
DVD!
We're talking about that next week. That's a damn good release. I'll say that. You need to buy it if you don't have it. Or, well, even if you have an older release, burn that one because this one's awesome.
If you like hydroponic, you can really, like, after you're done watching the films, store your weed in it because it's like a little container. Yeah. And the last movie we watched was The Woods. Lucky McKee's new movie. Which we'll be talking about that, I guess, next week, too.
Yeah, we don't want to give any of that stuff away. But we often have these fests around 5 or 6 movies a night, and it's enjoyable. Yeah. And I'm sure we'll have...
It's like a Halloween tradition.
The Granddaddy is usually on Halloween night. And I think, it wasn't last year, but 2 years ago, we actually watched 7 movies. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And one night, which took... got off
till like 3 a.m.
This year we've kind of got smarter because we actually check the times on the movies to make sure
they're all around 80, 90.
We didn't
minutes.
Do that time. I didn't get home till like 6 o'clock in the morning. Okay, next question is from Just of the Dead. Just for the hell of it, it says, "Hey, UB and CK, what do you think about the state of independent horror right now compared to several years ago? We all know what you think about the mainstream, but since there seems to be a boom of decent indie stuff at places like Best Buy right now, I'm curious if y'all think the indie scene is getting better."
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, there was a period of time like around the mid-80s when the indie scene was really awesome with like Full Moon and Troma and stuff coming out with all kinds of really good stuff on VHS. And then around the 90s, the early 90s, when like Todd Sheets and all those guys and Jerry Bookwalter came out with stuff, that was kind of a low point. Because after, like, Dead Next Door, there really wasn't that much stuff. Then Peter Jackson came along right around that time, too, and came out with, like, indie stuff, you know, like Dead Live and stuff like that. So that was some of the better-known stuff. Right now, it's kind of too crowded right now for me, actually. There's just way too many of the same kind of films being made, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think that there's better films that come out, too, because of that.
Well, I don't really...
There's so many movies that come out, there's a better chance that some of them are going to be good, you know. If you have 500 independent movies released, 10% of them are going to be pretty good, rather than like 10 years ago when, what...
Or it could just
100
be...
100 was released.
You could say that, or you could just say that people are just mass-producing films and don't really give a shit about the quality.
I think the thing...
And see, that's another thing, too, is that this digital video stuff is killing me. I don't... particularly like it at all, but everybody's using it, so I kind of have to get used to it.
I disagree with that. When it comes to independent stuff, if you're not doing the CG and all that crap, that's fine using digital because it's better than using camcorders, and that's what they were using 15 years ago or whatever.
Very few people nowadays know anything about how to use digital video and make it look decent. I can think of only about a handful of them right off the top of my head.
Yeah, but I think digital is actually... I think it's pretty cool if you take your time with it and you know what you're doing because you can really make something look, as we know, professional with it if you use it right.
Yeah, but like he said, though, there is a huge amount of films being released because you can use digital video now and it's so much cheaper than it was before. But unfortunately, to me, the downside of that is most of the films are just either average or unwatchable or somewhere in between.
I think that it's in better... shape now, though, than 10 years ago. The independent
definitely is than 10 years ago. I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
But I don't think you'll ever see another heyday like the VHS era. That's just me. Okay. Let's see what else we got here. From another one from Darkstar. "Hey, CK and Uncle Bill, are there any books, horror, sci-fi, that you would love to see made into a movie? And do you think that Stephen King's Dark Tower series will ever really be made into a feature film?
I don't read novels, so I'm the wrong person to ask about that.
Yeah, I honestly don't really read that stuff either. But I would say anything about Stephen King will be eventually made into either a miniseries or a movie, so that's just the way it goes with that.
Oh, of course. I don't read, like, these big, thick novels, like, because, what the fuck, I don't know anybody that reads that shit except for, like, women.
Yeah. And actually, my girlfriend's, like, a huge Stephen King fan, which is odd. I think most women are Stephen King fans for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't expect us to watch four movies a week and read the big fucking novel a week or whatever. That ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. Okay, and our last question is from Chris, a.k.a. Nocky Boy.
Yeah.
Nochi Boy, however you pronounce that. Says, I'm a huge fan of the show here in the U.K. I discovered you guys about 2-3 months ago, and I basically spent every weekend catching up on shows. I love the format and the feel. It's akin to discussing horror films with friends and sharing opinions, which is something the radio world seriously lacks within this genre. You guys are seriously representing something that should be upheld with great pride. Right. Anyway, not to bleed on about a load of old crap, I wanted to ask you just two questions that I'm not sure anybody's asked before. Obviously, I've heard the show, but cannot for the life of me remember if these were previously asked. So here goes. Number one, how did the two of you meet, and how long have you been friends? You seem like good buddies. Number two, being that Eli Roth is probably your main source of hate in the modern-day horror world, what questions would you seriously ask him should he ever appear on your show? It'd be one of those surreal interviews where I think what a lot of us are thinking would finally actually be said to the man. So those are my questions, and with that, I just have one more thing to say. Iron Maiden rules, motherfuckers.
That's right.
Yes, the Iron Maiden can't be sought, and the Iron Maiden can't be fought. Anywho, the first question is, how the two of us meet, how long we've been friends. You seem like good, but we're not really good buddies. I mean,
yeah, I hate this motherfucker.
We don't really even like each other.
Yeah.
To be honest, we just coexist for the purpose of this show.
A lot of people find that hard to believe, but it's true.
Yeah. And we don't really get along that well at all. Okay, so how did we meet? I think we met in, like, what, seventh grade? Sixth or seventh grade?
It depends. Like, okay, here's the thing that's funny and shit. My dad and his mom worked together.
They don't know what the place is.
We were really young, about five or six. And my dad was telling me that he put us in like a playroom together when we were like little fuckers. And I don't know, man. We've known each other for a long fucking time. But as far as...
We have known each other since we were probably about five, I would say. But as far as like actually... hanging out and like friends or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, that didn't start until we was about sophomores in high school.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah, that's true. Because we had like a class together one time with a couple of other people that come over sometime, watch horror movies and shit with
us. Wrestling pay-per-view.
Yeah, and we just started talking about wrestling. I pretty much think that's how we got
wrestling, and I think it was, I remember.
And Rebel John.
Something about, yeah. Faces of Death, too. Like, we got started talking about that.
Yeah.
Me, you, and Jared.
Yeah, this was all in science class.
Yeah.
It was Kendrick science class, which is
something
sad.
Like that. Yeah. But that's like, what, 12 years ago?
That's way too long ago. Like so, yeah. Anyway, that's how we met, and we're not good buddies now, though. I can't stand the motherfucker. Anyway, and it says, next question was, is that what would we ask Eli Roth seriously if we ever interviewed him? I see a lot of people think that if we interviewed Eli Roth, we'd try to, like, trick him and sabotage him and shit. But honestly, I think I would probably ask him to explain, like, certain scenes in his films, like, especially Hostel, and what exactly that he was trying to go for within those scenes to make me try to understand why it is that they're just so shitty to me.
Yeah, and I want to know if there's really a reason why the characters in his films... None of them, are you not supposed to like any of them? Is that the point? Because you really don't. You don't feel anything for any of them. So
I'd probably ask him, I don't think I would blatantly ask him about why it is that, you know, he blows Quentin Tarantino for a living, but I would ask him that, you know, why it is that, how those two got associated and some other questions about that. So I'm really curious to know why that is. But the thing is, we wouldn't actually... It would actually be a very good interview because we wouldn't, for one thing, kiss his ass like everybody else does, but we wouldn't sabotage him either, like I'm sure a lot of people would want to. It'd be a straight interview.
I will say this, that I really do think that we will have the opportunity at one time to interview him.
I'll say this right now. That will never happen.
I think it will. I really do.
Unless the dude just absolutely lives in a bubble and has no idea when he, like, you know, confirms the interview of what the
hell
we are.
You know that.
Yeah.
But
plus, we'd even have to get in contact with him, which is a damn near impossibility, too, right now.
Well, yeah, but I think we have mutual acquaintances, I guess.
So here's the thing, though. If anybody's listening and you can get us in contact with Eli Roth, you want to do an actual interview that's not just a bunch of bullshit, we'll be willing to do it.
We will do it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So
that's all
with
that's all
that, the that's
got.
The fan mail. So, you know, I guess we can go right to the interview that we did with Victor Miller.
Yeah, and if you've ever been curious about a lot of the stuff, you know, from the first Friday the 13th, how it all got started, the names, the places, and all that stuff, then this is the interview to listen to because he goes really in-depth with it.
Yeah, so check out the creator of Friday the 13th here on DudBit.com.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background as a writer? Prior to your involvement with Friday the 13th?
Background as a writer, yeah. I took every course that that Yale had in fiction writing. And then after I graduated, I realized I probably wasn't going to make a living at it. So I didn't do another thing. But let's see, I took writing from a number of really good people, one of whom was Robert Perrin Warren, who's... All the King's Men, I guess, then the remake didn't do too well a couple of weeks ago. But at any rate, Yale was busy teaching me how to be a scholar in English, and yet I don't think that's really where I was destined to end up. I got a graduate's degree in theater and literary criticism at Tulane University in New Orleans, so they taught me how to take plays apart. So Yale taught me how to take poems apart and stories and novels, and Tulane taught me how to take plays apart. And then I went north, and I was working at the Shakespeare Theater in Connecticut, and a friend of mine said you ought to write plays, and he graduated from Yale as a playwright, and so he taught me everything he knew. I wrote a play. I wrote several plays and got them, got one done off Broadway, and that was such an unhappy experience for me, I decided to become a novelist. Mm. So I did that for a while. And on the basis of that, I got a couple of jobs. I did a detective novel. I novelized about 9 Kojak episodes into paperback novels. And so I was busily learning a craft, the most interesting part of which was that... As a novelizer, I had to figure out what the difference was between the dramatic structure, let's say, of doing film and novels in a way that was sort of experiential. I had to figure it out on the fly, and I think I learned an awful lot doing that. And, I even got a job at one point. Somebody needed a novel turned into a movie, so I was now sort of being this middleman who was doing both things back to front and front to back, and just kept learning the craft, and then bumped into Sean Cunningham, with whom I made Friday the 13th. That would have been in the mid to late 70s somewhere. And about that time, he had already done Last House on the Left with Wes Craven.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but his career was, at that point, was not going much anywhere, and neither was mine. I was working at the Shakespeare Theater, and Sean was doing whatever he could. We both lived in Connecticut. So some idiot told us that what America wanted was a good family film. So we made a couple of good family films, and only to learn that we had been lied to, because we made some, you know, a couple of nice real pictures, and they made no money whatsoever. I'm not even sure they made their investment back.
Yeah, I think at the time, weren't you trying to develop a television series with him?
We were doing anything. I mean, I was we were just in each other's house, you know, 5-6 days a week. On Sundays, I was over at his house playing volleyball, and we were just looking for anything that would get us up, you know, and into the business.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're very much like a lot of other people out there who just are in somebody's garage, working on projects, working on what used to be Super 8 and now is on videotape and all kinds of other things. And so we had lots of different things going. And as I say, we made these two kids movies, and I liked them a lot. They were really nice, but they didn't make any money. And then finally, Sean, I guess it was in 1979, called me and said, Halloween just made a lot of money. Let's rip it off.
Yeah.
And so that's what I had to go and see Halloween. I bought myself a ticket and went and sat. And, you know, I had learned so much about structure of movies and novels and just the dramatic forms that it only took one viewing of Halloween to figure out what the format was. And I saw what was successful, and I owe to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, I guess it is, an awful lot, because they did it so well in that first Halloween film.
Yeah.
And so I just saw what the rules were in doing a successful modern, for then, 1980s version, horror was, and figured it out, went back, sat down with Sean, we talked a lot about it, and realized that one of the things that Halloween had proved so well was that whatever happened, you had to find a place where kids would be, teenagers, and where the adult world couldn't come and help them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in Halloween, it's basically Halloween Eve, and every time they look for help from the adult world, like banging on doors and saying, help me, I'm being chased, somebody inside the door says, it's just kids, forget it.
Right.
So I needed a venue. So that was actually the hardest part. I went away for about a week, and I would come back to Sean with a list of places and nothing and nothing. And I think it was about like the second week I came back, and I said, I got it. I think it's summer camp before it opens. And so we were off and running, and I think I wrote the script in another couple of weeks. Again, Sean, we had Sean had been director-producer of the other two projects, and he and I had discovered a really good way of working together. He was an awfully good critic, so I would give him a draft of the film, and he would then come back and ask questions and say, I'm not sure this works. Let's make this better or funnier or whatever, and I'd go back and rework it. It was a great partnership. I really enjoyed myself, and I learned a lot, and I think the proof is in the product that came out.
Yeah.
So we were off and running, and he had to start shooting that fall because the leaves at Camp Nobi Bosco were already turning orange when they had to shoot it, and it was supposed to all look, you know, early summer, late spring. So they went off and running, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. So as for the script, I was just curious how you came up with some of the, you know, more infamous names, like, for instance, Camp Crystal Lake.
Crystal Lake popped out of my head because there was a Crystal Lake in Connecticut, and I remember driving through it. I had a motorcycle back in the early or mid-60s, and I remember going past this absolutely gorgeous place, so that was Crystal Lake.
Yeah.
The family name of Voorhees, for Jason and his mom, came from some people I had gone to school with in the 50s. There was a woman whose last name was Van Voorhees, mm-hmm. and I always thought that was a really cool looking name. It had two O's and two E's in it, and it was kind of strange. And as for Jason, I had used the name Jason in a novel that I had done earlier. I have a son named Josh, and at one point it was going to be Josh, and then I figured I wasn't going to hang my kid with this name. So it just went from Josh to Jason.
And also, Crazy Ralph, which I guess was the voice of reason.
Oh, yeah, well, that Crazy Ralph's original name in the script, because Sean said an interesting thing, which is how I ended up doing Ralph. He was actually called Ralphie Ratboy. So Crazy Ralph came because Sean said, I think we need a way to announce to the audience and to everyone else that this world is absolutely crazy and that there's something really wrong with it. So I said, all right, there's a guy who goes collecting rats and he comes around on a bicycle. And we were often, in the script, I just put him down as Ralphie Ratboy. And, of course, the truck driver called him Crazy Ralph. Oh, that's just Crazy Ralph. You know, everybody's used to Crazy Ralph.
Yeah.
I mean, where I grew up, there was a woman who used to, she was a fully grown woman. I was like 14 years old, and we'd drive down the main street of town, and she would pop out from behind a tree with a cap gun and shoot all the cars that went by. I guess in the old days, they just figured that was fine, and you didn't need to hospitalize these people, but... so that was part of the beginnings of Ralphie the Red Boy.
Yeah. So you mentioned Halloween earlier. Were you familiar with any other movies from the genre at the time, or
of that time? Not really. I mean, Halloween was it because, as I have said on a number of occasions, I'm not much of a horror film aficionado.
Yeah.
I am what you call a card-carrying wuss. and I spent a good bit of my youth being terribly embarrassed about needing a nightlight on or having my mother check the closet or having to check under the bed and to make sure nobody was under there. And I had seen things. I'd seen Psycho, and I... To my way of thinking, Psycho was certainly one of the best and strongest horror films that I'd ever seen. You know, I mean, when I was six, there was a movie called Seven Keys to Baldpate. My last word, name is Baldpate, which was a comic horror movie, and I was 6 years old, and I ran screaming out of that. And the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and stuff like that, I took those very seriously. So I'm not much of a horror movie fan, but I remember, this is something that Sean and I talked about, basically, because we had both been schooled on Psycho. And Sean said, you know, one of the things that was most shocking in Psycho that made it such a world beater was that Hitchcock went and killed a major star in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And there's a Janet Leigh being stabbed to death, and you think, you know, at the inception of the movie that she's going to be the star of it, and instead she's just a corpse 20 minutes in. And so that's pretty much the reason I came up with the we had that young girl whose name I totally, because I haven't seen the movie in a couple of years, it was played by Robin Morgan. Right, okay. Anyway, she's killed in the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of a steal from the Psycho format.
Yeah, so I was wondering how it is that you developed the now kind of famous camp counselors not watching Jason revenge plot.
Oh, okay. That's... That's one of my favorites. It's because I learned from Halloween that there had to be some prior evil, something that had happened years before the movie started.
Yeah.
And it has to have been of sufficient weight. You know, in the case of Halloween, it was the babysitter being absolutely sliced up in pieces. And in this, I said, well, okay. What I think of as the strongest contribution that I made to this whole thing that's called Friday the 13th is the fact that Jason was a victim, not the victimizer. That the bad person, the evil, if you will, in this movie is a mother,
mm-hmm.
And we are raised, or at least I was raised, to think of mom and apple pie and
and Chevy trucks as the kind of stuff that that made America strong. And what I did was, for reasons best known to me and my psychiatrist, I turned it upside down and said, okay, here's a mother the likes of which you've never seen before. Because when the people were not paying, the people who were being paid to babysit her kid didn't pay enough attention,
mm-hmm.
And he drowned, she not only killed them, but she made sure that it was never going to happen again, not at this camp anyway, to any other child. And so she took essentially what is a really wonderful motivation, a mother avenging the death of her child, and went totally off the rails. I'm not suggesting this is a good way for mothers to behave.
Yeah.
But it just seemed, in some kind of alternate universe, Mrs. Voorhees is the mother I never had. You know, the woman who would do anything to avenge anything. So, you know, if I had had to face a bully in the fifth grade, if I'd had Ms. Voorhees, you know what would have happened to that bully.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was kind of fun, and I think that was, for me, that was the genesis of the thing, and the disappointment, if you will, of in the subsequent movies, none of which have I seen, except, you know, clips on clip shows,
mm-hmm.
Is that Jason became the villain.
Yeah.
When it was really Mom, and I think that was the fun thing for me, because originally I had not meant Jason to be retarded, certainly not to the point of looking like a monster. Or needing a hockey mask, and it was Tom Savini and Sean who took him as far as they did in terms of looking horrifying. I thought he was probably a slow, semi-retarded child who needed extra help and didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I had read too that Ron Kurz was uncredited co-writer.
Yeah, uncredited by Ron Kurz.
Yeah. It seems like I remember reading a lot of negative comments about him in the Chris Flake Memories book. I was just curious what your thoughts were on him.
Well, that keeps popping up. I mean, the scene that Ron wrote that I take no credit for whatsoever, because it actually... Sean told me that they were going to put in the scene with the motorcycle cop, and that was mostly an invention of the money backer and Ron Kurz. And the reason I was against it so much was that here I had spent all this time creating a place where the kids had no access to police.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring in an adult on a motorcycle, and then, of course, you show that he's an idiot besides. But at any rate, that's the one scene I did not write, had nothing to do with it. And but as for any other additions, whatever, to the film, those are not true. I know he mentions that he did the last thing, and the way I remember this happening, as far as, you know, Jason coming out of the water at the end of the movie, is Sean said to me, after I had finished the last draft on paper, he said, we need a chair jumper at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And I said, you mean like Carrie? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, so he comes out of the water. And that was the extent of the discussion, and I typed it up. So I don't know why so many people want the credit for something that I stole from Carrie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got it.
I mean, however, when it came for the credits arbitration, because I wrote this, you know, as a guild member, when it came for the credits arbitration, Sean said, no, I mean, there's just not enough to justify it, and that's why I got sole credit.
Mm-hmm.
In every movie, somebody's added something. I mean, you've got actors changing lines all over the place and everything. So it's really tricky. But
yeah,
I stand on the fact that when push came to shove, Sean, who was a part of the process from the absolute beginning to the absolute end, when Ron and Sean said, no, it's not justified.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
I've heard kind of conflicting things about this, too, but how much input did Steve Miner have in the process?
Well, in the process of writing the screenplay, none. Really, I mean, he would come in and out. I remember it was basically I would write it, Sean would go over it, give me notes, I would go back, rewrite, do all that kind of stuff. And every once in a while we'd talk to Steve, but to Steve's credit, he was there, he was on site for the entire shooting of the movie, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And so, if Sean had somebody to talk to and to discuss how they were going to do something or how they were going to treat something, I would imagine it would be Steve that he'd talk to. So, that's the extent of my knowledge.
Okay.
Was there anything in the original script that was cut that you would have liked to see and stayed in the movie?
Oh, lots. I mean, they were cutting stuff out all the time because, as I say, the leaves were turning orange. Mm-hmm. They were pulling, they had to pull branches out of the shot because here these fall branches, leaves were showing up in the background and stuff like that. And subplot between, the heroine and the camp owner.
Alice and Steve.
Yeah. And what's his name? You know, so that where she's up on the ladder nailing that gutter together and he comes up and talks to her. Steve Christie is the name of the camp director, whatever guy. And he comes in. That scene was one of a couple there was a kind of a subplot that she was having an affair with him.
Yeah.
And for time problems and all kinds of other things. And also, you know, when they got to shooting the movie, you get a much clearer idea of what you actually have when you're making a film. And it's like that old thing that sculptors always say, you know, I start with a huge piece of rock and I cut away everything that isn't the horse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's usually a process of taking things out. So, yeah, that plot. But I tell you the truth, I don't miss it a bit.
Yeah.
I think what, because the only thing Sean and I were trying to do when we set off to do this was to create as good a roller coaster ride as we could possibly come up with. And that was an image that Sean used over and over again when we were talking. He said, look, this is a roller coaster ride. You pay your money and you want to be scared.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, plots about love affairs between camp counselors and camp directors are not really to the point.
Yeah. Another kind of backstory that a lot of Friday the 13th fans are curious about is Jason's father, and if there was ever a backstory for that in the original script.
I never contemplated one. I just assumed that Mrs. Voorhees had... she seemed to me like the mother who only made love once and that was it.
Yeah.
And then he ran out on her. But I never had to do any real homework on that.
Okay. And speaking of Mrs. Voorhees, though, what did you think about Betsy Palmer's portrayal?
I thought Betsy was fabulous. I'm amazed at the difference between the, you know, because it was Estelle Parsons was originally supposed to play that role.
Mm.
And the timing did not work out because I guess Sean and the production got delayed in some kind of way so that there was a conflict and she couldn't do it. Now this is my understanding 26 years later, but I do remember. And then so Sean was pressed because he suddenly had to find the star, and we were using that same format. If you remember that Halloween basically did, they had, who was it, Donald Pleasance?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you have one star, and you know you're going to book that one person in for 1 week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the only person you can afford. I mean, you know, you can't afford any more. And so you construct the script in such a way that you only need a 1 week shoot, and then you put your money in that, and you, you know, you have a star. Well, here he was stuck with, he had Estelle Parsons 1 minute, as far as I remember, and the next minute he didn't. So he got in touch with Betsy Palmer, who lived about 20 minutes away from both of us, and we went and saw her. She'd read the script, and she said, oh, I just love this. This Grand Guignol, she referred to it as, which was the old French melodrama where they had a lot of blood and gore on stage. And we had a nice time, and then 20 years later or whenever I saw the, I guess it was the Warner Brothers interview with the European version on the DVD, whatever, and they interviewed Betsy Palmer, and she was sitting there with the interviewer, and she said, you know, I looked at this script, and it was a real piece of shit.
Yes, that's exactly what she said.
And I'm sitting there 20 years later, I said, well, honey, that's not what you told me in 1979. At any rate, you know, but I thought she was absolutely fabulous. I thought her Kill Her Mommy Killer was wonderful, okay. Clearly as did Harry Manfredini. And I would not. I think she's probably better than if Estelle Parsons had played it.
Mm-hmm. Did you make any visits to the set? And
I did. I went there on the occasion of. I think I brought some pages with me too. I've forgotten what, but anyway, I went there and got there in the afternoon, and then. The next day they were shooting the sequence in which Kevin Bacon gets the hunting arrow up through his throat, mm-hmm. and which is one of my favorite sequences, especially since whenever Kevin Bacon is interviewed, he seems to forget that he was in this movie. if you read these, you know, when a new film comes out and he's and people are interviewing him, they rarely mention, they will mention Animal House, but almost never Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was there watching the Tom Savini's absolute genius in making that thing work, because there was such a, you know, one of the parts of his mechanism broke in the, this had to be a one-take thing, and there he was, it was absolutely great, and everybody's applauding. And after the shot, Savini comes out from underneath the bed covered in sheep's blood. And people said, what the hell happened? And he said, well, the fitting of the tube let go, and so he had to blow the blood up through the tube and the arrow instead of using the squeeze ball.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, you know, talk about giving it all, giving one for the team. It was just great. So I was really glad to see that.
Now, what did you think about, we actually interviewed Savini a while back. What did you think about Savini's work as in an effects department?
I have more respect for Tom Savini every time I see CGI.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I looked at, you know, I know Gladiator or whatever it was a good movie and everything, but mm-hmm. there's something about computer graphics that just looks fake to me.
Yeah, we both agree.
Oh, good. I mean, I look at the stuff that's coming out now and people jumping up and flying through space and whatnot, and I say, boy, if Savini had done that, I would have a lot more respect for it. In fact, I just saw, oh, I know where this came up. 2 weeks ago, I went and saw Flyboys because I love World War One aerial mm-hmm. stuff, and, I went and saw that, and all of the German planes as they went by in computer graphic stuff all looked like they had just been bought. You know, everything was perfectly red, and the other planes were looked fabulous, and it was just so fake. And I ended up with a lot more respect for the guys who in the 20s and 30s went up in the real old airplanes to recreate those scenes back in the day, and when they were doing Silence and the early talkie films about the Hell's Angels and people like that.
Yeah, we were talking the other day that they don't seem to take a lot of time anymore to age things properly for the
exactly.
context.
Yeah, yeah, they don't give it that the fact that leather looks different, that canvas looks different, all these things. And the other thing about Savini was we were sitting in Sean's backyard. We had, I think, a second draft of the script between us. And Savini drove over from Pennsylvania and came to have his first sit-down with us. And he had gone through the script. He had a copy for a couple of days, a week, whatever. And I'll never forget, you know, him looking across and he says, okay, here on page 14, whatever it is, I see you got a got an axe in the face. Now, do you want a fake face and a real axe, or do you want a fake axe and a real face? Or, I mean, he's going through it like we were talking about what do you need for lunch?
Yeah.
You know, you want lettuce and tomato, or you want cheese with that? And I had never dealt with anybody in that profession, so it was absolutely, I was knocked off my pins. I was just so impressed, and I said, geez, I don't know. And so, because I had never, writers are notorious for saying, okay, and then the guy leaps over the Empire State Building, and then somebody else has to figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had done all this stuff before, and he knew how to put an axe in somebody's face,
yeah.
And the effect came out absolutely wonderfully. And I love the idea of the actress walking around, you know, with a styrofoam axe glued to her face.
Yeah, that was a good scene, I have to say.
Yeah.
But, so the film gets released in theaters.
Yep.
Did you go to the premiere?
Such as it was, I mean, I didn't go, there was no premiere. I mean, I went to screenings and things like that in New York at the production houses and stuff, but the premiere I went to was at the Connecticut Post Shopping Center in Milford, Connecticut, which is where it opened nearest to me,
mm-hmm.
and I went and saw it with real people. And we went in, you know, to the early show, and I went with a group of friends, and it was fun. And what happened in the experiential terms was I had no idea that half the audience was going to walk out before Jason came out of the water.
Yeah,
so
I think we talked to Manfredini, and he mentioned something about that.
Yeah, well,
they had already gotten up to leave.
Yeah, and what was great is that they had their, well, it wasn't that cold, it was like May 8th or something, but they had their coats and they were headed back, you know, like people do, I don't want to see the credits, I don't care. And suddenly, the other half screams at the top of their lungs, and suddenly the coat people whip around, and it was fabulous to watch, and that was kind of fun. And then secondly, as we came out of the theater, we must have gone to like the 7 o'clock show, so it was like the 8:30, 9 o'clock show, whatever it was. I looked, and there were like 250 people in line, and this was the first night it opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, my God, what happened? You know, because I was used to these nice little family films where if there were six people at a drive-in, that was a big audience.
Yeah.
So it was the Paramount publicity that really just packed the house.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you'd never seen any of the sequels, but were you ever approached about writing any of them?
No. I was never approached about writing in the sequels, and that's usually a function of the fact that you try to get a sequel for cheaper than you got the one that preceded it.
Yeah.
And if you already have done one, you're already more expensive. So, no, I've never been approached for any of the sequels.
Okay. And after the film, I guess it was around probably 1982, you and yourself and Sean Cunningham kind of had a bit of a falling out, I know.
Well, we had, we'd worked on, what was it? Oh, we worked on A Stranger Is Watching.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I had gone off to Los Angeles and sold a project that was in turnaround, and I came back, and Sean was working on Strangers Watching, so I did the rewrites on that. And then I did a couple of drafts of, Spring Break.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, Sean decided not to go ahead with my stuff on Spring Break, and that was it. I mean, we just never spoke again.
Yeah.
Until the Crystal Lake Memories party.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I talked to Sean, which was, what, last May?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Yeah.
So do you two actually keeping correspondence now, or just the
passing? Well, there's nothing really to correspond about, but we were perfectly friendly at the what you call it. Because I went on basically did some more screenplays that ended up in Turnaround, and then I got an offer to work in daytime television, and by that time I'd seen the sort of the handwriting on the wall. That it's really tricky. I mean, you can get a screenplay done maybe, and if you're lucky, you get a Friday the 13th, but the cutoff line is who can do more than one, who can do, you know, make a living out of it for the rest of their life. That's tricky. So I just, when I got the opportunity to do daytime, which was a regular paycheck, I took it.
Yeah.
And so I worked in daytime soap opera from 82 to, I just retired this year, 2006. I have three Emmys and a lot of friends in the business, and I enjoyed myself.
That's good. Now, I know that you get a percentage from all the films, right, since they use the Jason character in the Crystal Lake.
I get a fee, not a percentage, yeah.
Oh, okay, a fee.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned conventions. What was the Crystal Lake Memories?
I went to the Crystal, when it was the book party.
Okay.
To tell you the truth, I don't think I've been invited to a convention.
Oh, really?
Or if I was, I couldn't go because I had my other job. But no, I've never been to any of the conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that I wouldn't be interested. I would love to go.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of fans that would probably like to see you at a convention.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I get a lot of scripts. I get a lot of emails. I get all kinds of stuff. I mean, I purposely have a an email site where I get all of the emails, or, you know, I have my website for victormiller.com.
Yeah.
And I get all the emails that come through, and there are a lot of fans and people who, you know, I have a great fan in Japan who claims that he's my number one Japanese fan, and so I have a place where they can send posters for me to autograph, and I send them right back, you know, and do that. So, I enjoy the fact that I wrote something that people still care about, and I have a loyal fan group. You know.
Yeah,
that's a very nice feeling for a writer, I can tell you.
I know this was probably an inevitable question, but how do you feel about the rumors regarding the Friday the 13th remake / reimagining?
Oh,
/ whatever they're trying to do.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, you know, no. I mean, obviously nobody's talked to me about it.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry for that, but I have no idea what that's all about. Other than if I just hope that they use Tom Savini and not computer graphics. That it doesn't get slicker. Because one of the things I like when I see it, the movie, about once every year, a year and a half, and one of the things I like about it is that everything just looks so real. I mean, it was a low-budget movie.
Yeah, the effects do hold up really well, even today.
Yeah, and it doesn't have all the sort of the slick. The thing I've noticed that I really like about the modern horror films, when I see pieces or them on my cable, is the sense of humor. I think I love, you know, Scary Movie 1 through 4 and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that a lot of the modern horror films are sort of self-referential and make jokes at their own expense and sometimes go along the camp edge and... So that's kind of fun, but so I don't know what that will be, what that will bring us.
You haven't been contacted at all about rights or participation or anything?
No, that'll all be done between the union and you know, and the production house, whoever that is.
Okay.
So, you know, I have no idea. I think it's such a. I,
that it is about how can we squeeze another dollar out of this.
Yeah, exactly. What
it is. I'm not convinced it's how can we do this better. I mean, Friday the 13th was Friday the 13th. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty much the name, I think.
That's it gets a little too slick for my blood.
Yeah. But aside from that, I was curious about what you said. You just retired.
Yep.
And I was wondering what kind of future projects you had. Or I know you write novels too, don't you?
Oh, I do all kinds of things, and what I've been doing, because I have, as I say, I've been writing since. Let's see, I went freelance around 1974, and I have been writing pretty much to hire, you know, as a paid gun. Mm-hmm. For 32 years, and it's been a long time since I've actually sat down and written something that I just plain wanted to write for me, and I don't know what that's going to be, but right now I'm taking like a year off and just letting the stuff sort of percolate in my head and see what happens, and maybe nothing will happen. That'll be fine too.
We hope everybody enjoyed the interview with Victor Miller as much as we enjoyed doing it, and hope you learned something about the film and how he came up with a lot of the characters, and how Sean S. Cunningham and all those people just came together to make an iconic film masterpiece.
That's often imitated, never duplicated.
That's right. But actually, it was duplicated to begin with, so. But that's a point. I guess the last thing we'll mention is we've got a couple of announcements. I'm going to talk about a couple of things we're going to do later on. Right now, I want to mention that Zenon Pictures, who we had a little, you know, giveaway with a while back, they gave us a couple of DVDs giveaway. Just got the rights recently to a film called Snoop Dogg's Hood of Horror. I don't know if you
Hood of Horror.
Yeah, and they wanted me to mention this that the Snoop Dogg's Hood of Horror is premiering at Screamfest Wednesday, October the 18th.
That's this coming Wednesday.
And it'll be a red carpet event with the following cast members attending. Okay, Snoop Dogg himself will be there.
For shizzle my niece.
Danny Trejo, of course, will be there. And you got Lynn Shay is going to be there from Nightmare on Elm Street. And Snakes on a Plane, 2001 Maniacs, and all that stuff. Yeah, she's going to be there. You got Pooch Hall from, I don't even know who that other guy's from. But anyway, that's Wednesday, October the 18th from 7:30 to 9 at Grauman Man's Chinese 6 in Hollywood, California. I think pretty much everybody knows who that is. So if you want to check it out, ScreamFestLA.com. Next thing I want to mention is that I got an email from Stacy Roberts. And I know that we're huge friends with Stacy. She's Full Moon Pictures, Charles Band. Mm-hmm. And she wanted us to mention just this brief announcement that there's a film called Haunted Prison that stars Jake Busey and Stacy Keach. That's just going to be...
That sounds like a classic.
It's amazing, and it's about five college kids who are producing a documentary on an abandoned penitentiary, a prison with the highest execution rate in the country, and then eventually the prison itself becomes a huge entity that tries to swallow them up. So that's October the 14th, 2006, at 9 p.m. on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Holy shit.
Check that out.
I guess we should mention, though, too, that tonight, actually, at 9 p.m., on Stars, it is the rise and fall of the slasher film.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I'm sure Friday the 13th will be covered a lot in that documentary. I know that, you know, folks like John Carpenter and Rob Zombie are interviewed in that, and they go through tons of slashers from the late 70s to the mid 80s, I think, and beyond probably. So You definitely want to tune into that. I know I'm going to be recording it.
And a lot of people on there don't have Stars. And if you don't have Stars, we're sorry. But that's going to be killing.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Go to a friend's house.
Yeah. So we actually do want to definitely mention this, though. On the message board, there's a thread entitled something blah, 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 Big Ass Halloween Bash.
2006.
Yeah. So we just want to mention that you can go on the message board right now, and basically what you're voting on this poll is a movie for CK and I to do a commentary track over.
On Halloween night.
That's right. So right now your choices are as follows. You can vote for Cabin Fever, which, you know,
is the current front runner.
Yeah. You can vote for Halloween, the original Halloween, the only Halloween.
Yeah, that's a given on Halloween.
And Silent Night, Deadly Night 2. Okay.
With Eric Freeman's eyebrows.
The masterful classic that is Troll 2.
George W. Hardy, you can't piss on hospitality.
And the very odd, you know, strange and unrelenting zombie masterpiece that is Burial Ground.
My booby.
Yeah. Any of those movies, and a lot of people are bitched on there because they're not serious movies. Honestly, though, we can't do a commentary about something that would really be serious.
Halloween's sort of serious.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, you want the commentary track to be fun. We don't have any inside knowledge on any of these films. It's just going to be like two fans talking about a film. So for us to do something about like a great movie would be kind of redundant and stupid.
It could be.
Yeah. So that's kind of the reason why we picked some of the, you know, lesser known films like Troll 2 and Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, Burial Ground.
Yeah, but what this is going to be, though, I mean, we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago, or maybe last week, I'm not sure, that we wanted to do something a little different for Halloween night. We didn't want to do a show or any sort of special or anything, since we're already doing a Friday the 13th special again. I mean, there's no real point in us freaking killing ourselves trying to do two big specials in 1 month.
So. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, basically we just want to watch movies and relax and shit and not have to worry about crap like that.
And drink root beer and eat some KFC.
Yeah. Sniff some gold spray paint.
Which we do enjoy KFC a lot.
So I don't know if you got any more announcements that you want to make.
The T-shirts, you can still buy the T-shirts. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering about, you know, when am I going to get my shirt and everything. I'm going to tell you, folks, I'm going to try to get all the orders that have ordered up to now out by this weekend. I'm going to try. So you should be getting your shirts soon. I know a lot of people have got them because we've mailed out a ton already.
Yeah, that being said, if you haven't got your shirt yet, just calm down because I guarantee you everybody will get their shirt eventually.
Yeah, it's not an automated
system
that automatically, you know. You know, I know a lot of people like to believe that Deadbeat is a, we just have a huge factory with a bunch of, like, you know, Mexican children sending out all the shirts.
Which is not true. We actually have Brazilian children.
Well, yeah, that's true. And they're a little bit slower than Mexicans, I just want to say. But your shirt will get to you. But if you haven't ordered the shirt, you can go ahead and order that here on the deadpit.com store. You'll go on deadpit.com and see the luscious Lennox Miller on the front page. And click on the logo there, and I'll take you right where you can buy a shirt. And it's fairly cheap, too. And you can also buy, well, we've got signed KFC buckets on there.
We've got mini posters on there. And we'll soon be adding more merchandise, I'm sure.
Yeah. So that's all for this week, though. And everybody, I want to tell everybody to have a happy Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm. Go out and listen to some bluegrass, kick some ass.
Yeah.
Drink some sassafras.
We'd like to thank, again, Scab Boy. You can go to scabboy.net.
Uh-huh. And of course, the Colonel.
Yeah. Colonel Scott W. Perry. You can go to slickdevilentertainment.com. Check him out. And we'd like to a big thanks out goes to Victor Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You can go check him out at victormiller.com. And, you know, he's very fan-friendly, to say the least.
Yeah, he really is.
You can email him there and ask him whatever and tell him you like the interview.
And we hope that in the near future we'll have, you know, a bunch more guests lined up, and we'll let you know when we know what's going on. Until then, have a good Friday the 13th and enjoy the show. Hope you have.
Bye.
And enjoy yourself and go watch a bunch of Friday the 13th movies.
That's right. Part 5 and Part 7 specifically.
Yeah, any before, you know, New Line got a hold of them. Anyway, go enjoy yourself on this wonderful Friday the 13th. And we'll see you back here next week on Deadpit.com. Get your
bed.